Good morning, diners and travelers and art lovers.
There we go. Yeah, you stuck another one in there.
I did because as much as London is great for food and drink, and the museums are knockouts.
Did we say welcome to On the Menu?
No.
With Ann and Peter Haig?
I think we should say that.
Yeah, we probably should.
You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And we're doing our second 2013 program about
London,
the city of London, and introducing this particular program. We decided it was time you guys had some, not just food and drink, but a little culture.
Well, you know, some people think that all we do when we travel is eat.
Yeah.
I mean, including your brother-in-law.
Yeah.
but actually, that's not true.
Sometimes we don't eat. Sometimes we just drink.
Yeah, but we actually see museums.
We take advantage of the fact that there's some really wonderful, first of all, some wonderful permanent collections in London, but also some wonderful exhibits that are making their way around the world. And so we caught up with several of those on this particular trip, and I don't know, not in any particular order, just happened to be all on the pile together.
I do want to say that
go ahead.
The one that I really wanted to learn more or understand more about David David Bowie.
Oh, Bowie, I'm not sure which it's supposed to be.
Yeah, Bowie, I think it is.
And we learned a little bit, but the noise got to us.
It was just too much. I think he's a very mysterious person. And I guess he's reinventing himself because he's just releasing a new album.
But he had a huge show at the Victoria and Albert Museum.
And it was jammed.
Absolutely, totally jammed.
Half of those people, I can't believe they were so young that they actually knew him in his day.
But they know him now, and I guess he's very smart. I guess he's about to produce another LP because he just turns out that he's having another burst of fame.
Uh-huh.
And it did remind me a little bit of the Alexander McQueen exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art because he sure dressed up in some fancy clothes.
Yeah, I'd like to see that punk show at the Met.
Want to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see about that in due course. But anyway,
right. Back to what did we see?
Hold on a second.
Yes.
We first of all, at the Victoria and Albert Museum, which is conveniently located just 5 minutes walk from Harrods, so you can spend a little money there too if you'd like. But always they have some very interesting exhibits on, and this one. The one we were just referring to was dedicated to the life and times of David Bowie, who is, it turns out, quite a mean painter. And I think,
although
he's celebrated for lots and lots of other things, he attributes painting for helping him to get over what was a fairly nasty drug habit.
Yeah.
And also in the Victoria and Albert Museum, a very interesting show featuring on trade and diplomatic relations, I guess, between the Stuarts of the 17th century in Britain and the Tsars in Russia, and exchange of all kinds of pleasantries and all kinds of generous gifts through the port of Murmansk, which is near Archangel, through the Northeast Passage, I think it's called. So there were some very exciting pieces of little things to give away, made out of solid silver or made out of solid gold.
That's a really interesting period, actually, in Russia's history.
And of course, the renewal of relations between the Tsars and the Stuarts after the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 and Charles II. So that was an interesting little byproduct too. Spent a few minutes there. Next on the pile is the Tate Modern. Always a fun place
to
go.
I love that place.
It's just such an astounding reuse of an old building. They must be doing something in what they call the, it's not the energy room, it's not the boiler room, it's the turbine room.
Turbine.
Because this was a huge coal-fired electric generating turbine. And it's one of the few places where truly massive artworks can be shown. And they had that closed off, which I suspect means that there's something new going in there. Something new and astounding. But a really remarkable exhibit we saw there, is it Roy Lichtenstein or Ray Lichtenstein?
Yeah,
you're supposed to know. You have the sheet.
Well, first of all, it's Lichtenstein is the correct way of doing it, yes.
And some really, because he's known really for these sort of large cartoonish things, but you see a whole career dedicated to some really exciting and interesting painting of all different kinds, some comic strips, giant comic strips, some faux Chinese, was it Chinese or Japanese?
A room full of interesting nudes.
It was a new perspective
on Roy Lichtenstein. It showed works that, I mean, I gave him a whole new, I mean, I studied art history, so
yeah,
I myself was pretty surprised by some of the things.
Well, we're going to go on there to your study of art history, which it turns out we discovered is incomplete in terms of Renaissance painting.
Hello.
Because you hadn't even heard of Federico Barocci, who was the subject of a very interesting exhibition of art at the National Gallery.
I could have told you I didn't like it because, I mean, he was influenced by Raphael. I never liked Raphael much anyway. When I was teaching art history, I used to skip over the whole Raphael
word. Well, anyway, there's good old Federico Barocci, who was, I think his patron must have been that King Frederick or Crown Prince or whatever it is who built that huge palace in Urbino.
Well, I was not the only one who was surprised that he had this big show, but I guess it was the first show he's had outside of Italy. But nobody else seemed to have heard of him either.
You did have an interesting conversation with two other art lovers who said they hadn't heard of him either. But we also made a quick tour of the National Gallery itself, which has a wonderful set of Rubens from different periods of his life and different periods of his painting style, all in one room, really fascinating, probably outdone only by that wonderful room of Rubens in the Medici Palace in Paris, which you always keep on asking me, where is that? And I tell you where it is, and then next time you ask me, I remind you again, because I can actually remember a few things. So that was the National Gallery.
And then
Gallery.
You got to meet another new artist to you is Schwitters.
Kurt Schwitters.
Kurt Schwitters, and we found out that he actually spent a lot of time in England.
In fact, he spent the last 8 years of his life in England because he was running away from the Nazis in Germany, then running away from the Nazis in Norway.
And then he got imprisoned by the English.
Yeah, found himself, he was interred. He was in an internment camp.
Oh, okay. That's different. That's what we did to the Japanese during World War II.
And not quite a year. And it turned out that during the time he was there, the commandant of the internment camp he was at was an art lover, so that he encouraged...
That sounds like a fun place to be at the time.
He encouraged a number of artists, including Schwitters, to do a lot of very interesting work. And what are they called? They're called Mertzes, these collections of paraphernalia.
And there's one we never did find out where that was in the Lake District.
Well, the wall moved. He only managed to get one wall done before he died. Mm-hmm. And then they had some discussion
Ambleside.
Over. And he lived near Ambleside. And we have to do more research on Schwitters, because Schwitters at the Tate Britain rather than the Tate Modern was definitely a pilgrimage worth making. But candidly, if you do go to Tate Britain, which is just a little bit out of the way, the place to go is the rooms full of Turners, don't you think?
Oh, I mean, an
astounding collection of Turners.
I mean, there's so many different artists there.
And here's a little something that I told you that you didn't know, and that I only vaguely recall hearing recently, that the money behind the Tate was actually the money generated from the production of sugar. Sugar products,
right.
And a company called Tate and Lyle, which I think was actually headquartered in Liverpool, mm-hmm. but which controlled the trade in sugar from the West Indies back to the United Kingdom, and made all kinds of other wonderful products, including table sugar like treacle.
Yeah,
we won't go into treacle too much, I guess.
Thank you.
But the Tate Britain certainly worth a visit. And one we shouldn't forget, because two we shouldn't forget. Two really interesting collections. One, the National Portrait Gallery always seems to manage to collect something really interesting aside from its own portrait collection. So last year we were at Lucian Freud exhibit, which was really amazing. Wonderful. And this year they were featuring photographs by Man Ray.
Yeah, which was...
A really startling exhibition.
It was amazing. Yeah. His portraits are knockouts.
The only trouble is many of them are really small.
Yes.
So if you're optically challenged, it's a bit of a handful to get close.
Yeah. Now people had magnifying glasses even.
Well, we didn't think to bring those. There were magnifying glasses at the Royal exhibit. Mm-hmm. At the Victoria and Albert,
Because of the detail. So
you could see some of the ornate detail on some of the pieces that were there. And last but not least, a really charming collection in a place that used to be called Somerset House, I guess it still is, which was the Registry of Births, Marriages, and Deaths for several centuries, but which is now home to the Courtaulds Institute, which is an art school and I guess an art institute, as well as a very interesting collection of art in its own right that belonged to, I guess, Mr. Courtauld. But they had an exhibit which we wanted to see about the young Picasso called Becoming Picasso, and also some Picasso and Matisse drawings. So it's a place that is a little bit out of the way. Not everyone even knows where it is. It's a few steps from the Savoy Hotel on the Strand, just in case you're wondering what it's close to. And another fine gallery well worth a visit. So we hope that you'll make sure that you look at what's on in London from our perspective, just as we did and which we do every year, and I'm sure you'll enjoy.
And of course, all this artwork makes you very hungry.
Oh, it does. Okay. So right after we get back from this break, we'll talk about how we slaked our thirst and fed our appetites. So we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and as promised, we will give you the inside scoop on some really new and fun places to be eating in London.
Yeah, this is really after the art. This is the theme of today's program. Three very interesting new ventures, all pretty young people, two startlingly young people.
Oh wow! Yeah,
and this one starting out with a slight journey outside of London to a little place out in the country. Near the town of Marlow, which itself is near Maidenhead, which is near Bray, the home of the Fat Duck and the Waterside Inn, as Luke Thomas, the proprietor of Luke's Dining Room, did mention when we said who comes here. He said, "Well, it's really interesting. This little corner of this planet Earth just happens to have six Michelin stars, all in the same little town of Bray, not very far from Marlow, and." I'm guessing that Luke Thomas might be headed in the same direction as those two guys, don't you think? I mean, he's 19 years old. He's had Luke's Dining Room in Marlow for just a little over a year, I think. He was the best young chef in the United Kingdom.
When he was 16, I think.
No, just this last year.
Oh, okay. His first award was when he was 15 or 16, I can't remember
Right, just a remarkable young man with, incidentally, a slight resemblance to Justin Bieber.
He looked, yes.
We told him, and I don't know whether he thought it was a compliment or not. I think maybe he did. But he's a very composed young man, that's for sure. And we found out not just that Luke's Dining Room itself is a fine establishment and a restaurant that also has a number of rooms attached to it, so that's also very helpful. If it turns out you don't want to drive or you don't want to take the train all the way back to London, so you can stay over. But most exciting news is he's going to open a pop-up restaurant in London. I don't know that I remember the name.
I think we talked to him about
it.
So let's listen to what he has to say.
Here's young Luke.
I never in my life even thought about a chef protégé until the modern era of such extraordinary chef talent. And here I am sitting across the table a 19-year-old master chef, just about, named Luke Thomas, which is UK anything. You know he's from Wales, with the name of Thomas. And what part of Wales are you from, Luke?
I'm from North Wales, so just over the border from Chester and Liverpool.
Right, okay. And you started at age what? Of you
age
19
12.
Now?
Age 12 I started in the catering industry.
And why? I mean, how did you explain this?
You know, I've always had a huge love for, you know, my family are huge foodies. We grew all of our own vegetables at home, and that I spent a lot of time with my grandmother when I was younger, and she cooked every single day, and she spent all day cooking. She never worked. She was always at home looking after the family. Yeah, she was well. She looked after the family, and she would spend all day preparing food. She would make a dessert every day. She would make a main course every day. So food was always very important to us. When I started high school, secondary school, whatever you want to call it, I soon discovered that sitting behind a desk and writing in books wasn't the type of thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to be stood in a kitchen, hands-on, creating food. And that was when it twigged that there were so many opportunities in the catering industry, and there was a huge push to get young chefs into the industry, that there was an opportunity for me to go and already gain some experience in the industry. So by the age of 12, I was working at local butchers, fishmongers, and, you know, already at that point, I was, you know, working in a local restaurant.
Yeah, you've put together a really impressive mound of different experiences in the whole culinary field.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that it's so important that, you know, once you've got, a basic grounding and a basic training, and that you've spent a bit of time in one kitchen, that for me, I wanted to not necessarily even spend a year, but whether it was one day, 1 week, 1 month, or 6 months in different kitchens over the world, just to really see what chefs are doing, to get inspiration, to look how they run their kitchens, to look at the way they put food together, what their food philosophy is. So that was really the inspiration for what I'm doing now.
Well,
the time
done a
I
lot
spent.
Of stages with some very impressive people.
Yeah.
Like, what are some of these impressive people? I mean, I could say, like, Grant Ackett, Selenia, right?
Yeah, Heston Blumenthal, The Fat Duck, Jamie Oliver, Barbacoa, Gary Rhodes in London and Dubai, and people. And I think that when you look at these guys, they're all so different in the way that their food style and their philosophy and the way they're trained. It's so interesting to see that, because it helps, you know, essentially we're looking at, you know, the Luke Steinerman menu in front of us. That's all that helps in putting this menu together.
Well, I guess we ought to really explain where we are. It's called Luke's Dining Room in Sanctum on the Green. Wherever are we? It's sort of in the middle of nowhere, isn't it?
Yeah, we're located in a village called Cookham Dean, which is in Berkshire. So we're just outside of Marlow and Maidenhead. We're about 40 minutes from central London and easily accessible by the train. But I think that you know, the beauty of being around here, although we're quite in the stick, so to speak, of that, you know, we're very enclosed and it's a private area, but we, you know, within 5 miles of here, you've got the Fat Duck, the Waterside Inn, Adam Simmons restaurant, you've got the Hand and Flowers, you've got the Heinz Head. So we're in a real foodie area where people do really appreciate their food.
Specifically as dining destination.
Absolutely. Dining. You always have your local market, but essentially when you're in an area like this where you're surrounded by amazing gastropubs, 1, 2, and 3 Michelin-starred restaurants. I mean, there's 3 Michelin-starred restaurants in the four 3 Michelin-starred restaurants in the country, and we've got 2 of them within 5 miles. It's a real foodie area. It's a real foodie area. Yeah.
Now, speaking of foodie areas, let's break the news that you are about to position yourself right dead in center in Mayfair in London.
Absolutely.
Not a crabby address there.
No, well, we're opening up at 29 Old Burlington Street, which used to be MC Mayfair, which is MC Nightclub. You know, they've had some amazing chefs there, Gary Holyhead, Joel Antonews, and now I'm taking over the restaurant space as a pop-up called Retro Feasts, which is taking people back to their childhood and reinventing our childhood favourites, whether it's things like Spam and Eggs, whether it's a fish pie, whether it's a rump steak.
What Grant Ackett did with
Correct. Yeah, exactly. It's that. It's the concept of where people come into a restaurant and they can look at the menu and be able to tell a story of, well, we remember when grandmother used to cook that. We remember when we used to have that when we were on our way home from school. We remember those desserts from lunchtime in school. And that's the idea of this concept that, you know, you can come in, you can have a peach melba, you can have a spotted dick, you can have a Black Forest gatto, but it's reinvented, it's brought to life, and it's done in such a way that food is presented
Why
here.
Why do you think everybody's suddenly nostalgic? I mean, the theme for you're not interested in the Metropolitan Museum fundraiser or the Costume Institute, but it's 70s because it's punk is the theme. It's 70s. Why are people interested in that all of a sudden?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily people who are interested all of a sudden. I just thought that I wanted to come into London. I had this amazing opportunity to open up in Mayfair, and I thought, you know what, here's where I do the serious food at Luke's Dining Room. I'm going to have a little bit of fun. There's a nightclub downstairs. Okay. I'm not calling it a restaurant, I'm going to call it a social diner where people can come, there's no reservations, you take a table, you select five dishes that you want, and they come when they come. We've got an amazing cocktail list consisting of things like Baby Sham that people remember, things like Tequila Sunrise, which are cocktails that people remember from their childhood too. And it's the idea that people can come, and it's a bit of fun. It's not a serious foodie destination, but I want them to come and go, wow, we remember ham, egg and pineapple, but this is the most amazing ham, egg and pineapple we've ever tasted.
Well, are they totally in awe? You've won awards such as the best young chef in the country and all this. Are people amazed at how talented and accomplished you are at age 19?
Yeah, I think that there's, you know, people are always interested to hear, you know, how it happened and the story behind it. And do I have two restaurants at the age of 19? Soon to have two restaurants.
It's mind-boggling, totally mind-boggling.
Yeah, but, I always say that footballers who play in the Premiership or who play wherever, that, you know, whether they're 17, 18, 19 or 29, they can still deserve a place on the pitch because they might have the right talent and the right attitude and they're the right person for the team. And I just think that classically with chefs that you build your way up the ladder, and when you're 30 or 35 and you've built your way up here and there, that then you open a restaurant. But the opportunity came, and I thought, you know, at the age of 18, if you were offered, you know, if you're a football fan and you're offered to play for Liverpool, you wouldn't say, oh, no, I'll wait till I'm 30. You'd say, what number shirt can I wear? And that's why when I got offered this, I didn't think, oh, I'll wait a few years. I thought, great, when do we open? Because that, you know, it's such an exciting opportunity, especially at such a young age. But any age, this is an amazing opportunity.
When you were talking about food philosophy, two questions of you. One, I want to know who your food chef heroes are.
Yeah.
And two, have you, in your mind's eye, have you actually formed a philosophy of food at your young age?
Yeah.
Start with your heroes.
I mean, heroes, two people. One, Heston Blumenthal. Two, Jamie Oliver. I admire...
Totally the opposite personality.
Completely, but I think from what I admire with Heston is that it's so unique, and from what I can remember...
He's brilliant.
It was the first chef that I was completely amazed by, in the sense of, I've never seen food like this before. Yeah, I've never seen cooking like that before. And at the age of 15, I spent some time doing some experience at the Fat Duck, and to see what they were doing in that kitchen was just mind-blowing. But the reason I'm such a fan of Jamie Oliver is very simply because of I think he's inspired the nation to cook very differently to how they used to. I think he's inspired the way people eat, and especially from my point of view, I remember growing up watching Jamie Oliver's programs, watching The Naked Chef.
The Naked Chef, right.
Exactly. And suddenly, if we were to have a salad at home, it would be iceberg lettuce, chopped up cucumbers and tomatoes, and some salad cream. But suddenly, Jamie Oliver's salad was rocket, parmesan, peaches, parma ham. And what he did was bring it all to life, and he made food a lot more accessible, a lot more fun, a lot more hands-on. And, you know, that's very simply why... You know, Jamie did inspire me to cook.
He doesn't have a whole lot of fans in Virginia.
Oh, right, okay.
He tried to revolutionize the food menu in the school district in the most obese town in the United States, Huntington, West Virginia, and they didn't get along.
And L.A. blocked him. They tried to block him out of the school. So.
Wow.
And the latest thing is people are accusing him of being fat.
Really?
Okay. Well, he's put on a few pounds, right?
Yeah.
Talking about putting on a few pounds.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the philosophy of food and then link it to some of the dishes on the menu?
Okay, very good. That was the second question. Have you developed in your mind's eye your own philosophy of food, even though you were 19 and sort of at the start of your career?
I think it's difficult to develop a food philosophy at such an early age, but to have a food style. I would say my style of food is British. It's modern British. You look at some of the dishes on the menu. You hear, for example, seared scallops, mussel curry, fritters and mango. That essentially, we've taken a dish, a curry, which is one of the nation's favourite dishes now. And we've taken that and said, okay, we want to put it on as a starter. We want to lighten it up. So we've got a basic curry sauce, which is made with coconut milk. And we've got fresh mango in there, so it's a bit lighter. We serve it with seared scallops, which are delicious, just cooked, and mussel fritters, which give you the texture. Serve it with an almond cream, which is obviously a classic part of something like a chicken korma or a chicken tikka masala, that you've got a touch of nut in there. So the idea is that we take a dish that is very popular in the British culture and deconstruct that and put some elements on there to turn it into a restaurant dish. Things like a fish cake, you know, it always sells, but we put shrimps in there, we put crab, we put blitzed up scallop meat in there, we put haddock, we
sounds
put
really good,
salmon.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got tartar sauce, but we use lemon zest and we use capers and deep fried capers. So the idea is that it's just taking classic dishes and classic flavours and British favourites and deconstructing them and building them back together. But with this, it's a lot more, I would call it restaurant-y, as opposed to what we're going to be doing in Mayfair, which is a lot more fun. We're taking, you know, one of my favourites from a childhood was fish in parsley sauce, and it came in this horrible plastic bag. It was a piece of fish with this sauce, and you boiled it for 6 minutes, you took it out
You're
of the
kidding.
Packet, and it was just such a comforting thing, and it was so homely, and it was so flavoursome. So we've taken that dish and basically gone, right, okay, fish and parsley sauce, we're going to take a piece of halibut, we're going to pan fry it, most beautiful fish, parsley sauce, we're going to make a beurre blanc with some smoked pancetta and whisk in a bright green parsley puree at the end to give it that real fresh flavour. So it's fish and parsley sauce, but broken down, so it's, you know, bringing the luxurious element to it, so it's halibut, and then that parsley sauce, but using a vibrant green parsley puree to give it the colour, but also to give it a real parsley flavour. So that's the idea of what we're doing in Mayfair.
Now, you have here for under the desserts a selection of artisan cheese. Zizza. How wrapped are you in that whole artisanal concept? Because you're in the right area for it, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, when people say, you know, do you use local produce? Yes and no. I use British produce. If I can get rhubarb that's grown in the field next to me, I'll pick it up. But if I can get rhubarb from Yorkshire, and it's better,
yeah,
I'll get it from Yorkshire.
That's so, where Peter's from. He's from the Yorkshire Triangle.
I'm from just outside the rhubarb triangle.
Or the rhubarb triangle.
But I do know where it is, and I've crossed it on hundreds of occasions.
Well, I think that, you know, that's my philosophy, that I will use the whole map to find the best produce. So, but of course we do like to support our local suppliers, and we have an amazing cheese supplier just around the corner from us. He has an amazing French deli, and we use his cheeses. He comes in, he brings in 10 different cheeses, he'll tell us where they're from, the story behind them, and we select the three that we think will work, and then 2 weeks later we change them again. So that's how we select our cheeses.
What is sticky red cabbage?
Well, what we do, we braise the red cabbage in port, red wine, orange, cinnamon, and basically at the end of the cooking process, when it's really nice and tender, we add sugar so it starts to caramelize and go really nice and sticky.
Huh. Well, the thing I was thinking of was, I was reading your resume and all of the traveling you've done, is I can see you next heading out to the Far East and the Middle East for those experiences. True?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, you know, there's the one thing I always say to people is that nobody ever stops learning, and, you know, part of the plan in the next few years is that I go and travel again, I go and work in more kitchens, because everything changes. Food changes, people's philosophy change, the offering changes, people get better, and, you know, it's important to keep on top of what's going on in the food world.
Well, did we mention you also look like Justin Bieber?
did we mention that? We did. Boys and girls of a younger age. we don't know if Luke sings, but we bet he probably does, and he probably does it well, just like he does everything else well.
He looks good with the mic.
He does look good with the mic, too.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, Luke, it's been real experience and pleasure for us to meet you.
Hey, let's do a couple more dishes that we might have for lunch.
What else for lunch?
Well, we have the chef right here. We might.
Yeah. Well, I have to give you the venison dish, which is a venison saddle with a venison cottage pie, yeah. Braised venison shins, delicious baked potato scratchings on top. So, but we have a special menu prepared for you for lunchtime.
Okay.
Anyway, so.
All right.
Well, we'll have to report on it afterwards, listeners, and we'll give you a blow by blow. We promise. And Luke, thank you so much. I'm so glad to catch up with you. The news about going into Mayfair sounds really exciting. Tell us again the name of that restaurant.
It's called Retro Feast at 29 Old Burlington Street.
And it opens when?
May 15th.
Just around the corner. And is there a website that people can find out all about Luke's?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to lukethomas.co.uk, you'll find information about Luke's Dining Room, Retro Feast, and all the other exciting stuff that's going on.
Great.
Perfect.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's a pleasure to meet you. I'm so glad that we came out to see you, and it's a sunny day as well.
Yeah, well, thank you very
much.
How
about that?
And we'll be back with another exciting new dining establishment in London right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I guess we ought to give credit that this next place was so new, but somebody who we admired and whose opinion we respected directed us to try it, and so we did. And it's called the Newman Street Tavern.
In fact, not only did Jeremy Lee from Quo Vadis recommend
it,
he said he was going there, and we jotted it down, and somehow or other we managed to get in touch with them on just a couple of days' notice, and it was a pleasure to go there. And the chef partner, Peter Whedon,
yeah,
has cooked in all the right places, learned his trade very well, and really has a very, very interesting establishment, a very, very interesting menu, and some really au courant attitudes about putting ingredients first, about where quality ingredients come from, how you should respect them, everything down to making sure that his staff gets a good meal. So he's doing things the right way. But the result is not a boring establishment. The result is an extraordinarily lively establishment. And let's on the air say, Antonia, if you're listening, thank you so much for making our visit so enjoyable with your absolutely wonderful service. So we had a great time. I think we spent altogether 2.5 to 3 hours there. I don't think we had another meal that day because we certainly didn't need one. So the Newman Street Tavern, not too far from Oxford Street, is a good place to go, a good place to go to spend a few hours of your time. And the wonderful part about it is not only that, but you'll get a chance to rub shoulders with some of the locals if you feel like it, because there was a group of people who were celebrating a birthday party who were obviously right from that neighborhood. Anyway, here's Chef Peter Whedon from Newman Street Tavern.
I would say maybe no more than 2 days ago, I really didn't know anything about the Newman Street Tavern, and that's probably not too surprising since it's very new. We're going to talk to the chef co-owner here, Peter Whedon. Peter, you're a delight. We hit it off on the right note right from the beginning. You're interested in all the same things that we and most of our listeners are interested in also. Welcome, first of all.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say. And I think, as you point out, we have lots of shared interests in terms of food and kitchens. And we're so lucky here. And I think we really just have great relationships with our suppliers, which makes us feel every day that we're doing good food and making customers happy. And that's where we start. So that's a good place to be.
You may be even cheating because the suppliers are really fabulous. Let's back up a little bit, though. How did you get here? 4 months old. Everybody's talking about this restaurant now, and it's also a very comfortable, happy place to be. Where were you, and how did you get here?
So I started washing pots as pretty much every chef has done for the since the beginning of time. We start washing pots, and then we realise that when we taste what food's left in the pan, it tastes good, and we want to know how to make it. So we start asking questions, and people explain things to us, and we pick stuff up along the way. I was lucky enough to get the job of cleaning the dry stores out, and it was there that I discovered that I really enjoyed eating chocolate whilst I was clearing out the dry stores. And you know, I did that and peeling bags of carrots to be helpful and opportunities to do more, and it seemed like a good place. Kitchens worked well for me as well as me working hard for them. Did that through school, and it helped me pave my way through my education. And having finished all my education, my degree, I thought, right, back to college, get a good foundation in cooking, and then I can start working in the industry and work as a professional. So I came to London about 10 years ago and worked for Conran Restaurants. So Terence Conran is, you know, such an iconic figure and has made such a huge influence, huge impression in the world of restaurants. And that served me really well and had great opportunities and worked hard and ended up as a head chef in one of the restaurants where I opened the Paternoster Chop House for them back in 2004. Then I met some very interesting guys who wanted to do business but seemed to be on the same wavelength as me. Were very interested in suppliers and getting that relationship really working properly. But also interested in all the other things that support that in terms of looking after members of staff, in terms of making the right environment, in terms of investing in the right way, and building something sustainable in terms of business as well as something sustainable environmentally. And it all seemed to fit very well. So we're here in Newman Street in Fitzrovia in London. So it's a pretty busy place just off Oxford Street, which is full of shoppers all the time. And we're in the middle of the media area, which has got lots of young people who've got pretty open minds about food, and it makes it a good place to open a restaurant and to do food, which is real. You know, there's no facade here, there's no ego in the kitchen, it's just good, simple food, and the people here seem to really embrace that.
Now, we just got a tour of the kitchen. You had the benefit of this place was old and then old, and it's got it and it's new now. What do you say? It's new, but it looks like an old neighborhood pub in many ways. You go into that kitchen and you've got every modern technical support system going in that kitchen, as well as a really, really accomplished staff. How did you pull this together so quickly?
Well, yeah, luck and a following wind did a lot of the benefit there, but I think having worked in London for the last 15 years, built relationships with people, and I knew that I had staff that I could call on when it came to opening a restaurant to, you know, to start forming a team. We were very lucky. We picked up a pair of chefs who were together. They had really good background and they worked very hard and they worked well for us. In terms of bringing that team together and trying to build a culture, I think that's the most important thing, to build a culture front of house and back of house and really make everybody understand what it is that you're trying to achieve. And you have to do that by leading from the front and making it very clear, explaining to people why we're cooking this amazing food, why we're buying the fish from the fishermen down in Cornwall, why we're supporting them and why they support us in return. And once everybody understands those kind of relationships, it makes them much more comfortable and more confident to pass that on to the customer. Our waiting staff to have complete confidence in the kitchen, and we want them to then be able to go to the customer with confidence and say, food here is really great, and the staff get looked after and we're really trying to look after you. And it just makes everything fit together much, much better. There's nothing forced here.
Let's back up a little bit. Let's just make it a given that you do all what I view as the right things with sustainable, local, seasonal, all that. But let's break it down a little bit into, like, let's talk about the producers of your meat and how you get your meat in and how you butcher in-house. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So about 10 years ago, I bought my first beef carcass, and it was a bit of a challenge. I'd never butchered a whole carcass before, and it's a relatively daunting thing. Yeah, and it's big, it's a lot of meat. And as a chef, you think, well, I should have the skills and the understanding and the knowledge to be able to cook all these pieces of meat. And I think, really, I was kind of overwhelmed by it because I didn't know what to do with all of it. And I think as a cook in London, when you're a line cook, you believe the hype that, you know, when you're doing big numbers and it's busy all the time, that you're capable and competent as a cook. But actually, it's not until you start to really take a good look at yourself and say, well, can I actually do this? Can I butcher a carcass myself? Can I break it down? Do I have the skills to use the whole carcass? That you start to realize, well, until I know that, then I can't really call myself a decent cook. So I thought, well, we'll persevere with this and we'll speak with the farmers and we'll buy direct and get the best quality carcass, and then I'll make sure that I can butcher it properly and make sure that I can look after it and treat it with the respect that the farmer's given it and get it to the plate and make some really delicious food for the customers. So it just felt like the right thing to do. So here, 9-10 years on from that first carcass, and now I have a butcher who comes to work with me one day a week. He's 73, and he's got quite a bit of experience working with me. He retired 12 years ago, but starting working for me 8 years ago. Now, without his help, it would make it much harder. Breaking down a cox is a really skilled job. I've learned a lot of butchery from him, and as we've worked together, he's learned a bit from the kitchen guys. They have a different perspective to the guys who work in butcher shops. And together we formed a really good relationship where he really appreciates the way that we see his skill as being really valuable.
I just want to interrupt proceedings for just a second, because we're upstairs in the restaurant, which is a dining space that's used probably mostly in the evening. But sitting at a round table next to us are the chefs we just photographed in the kitchen, and they're having their staff meal, and it smells delicious. I'm thinking to myself, if only I had room to eat, give me a plate of that.
Staff food is one of the things that in kitchens gets so overlooked. You end up with a plate of gruel that turns up in the middle of the shift and you don't have time to eat it. And for us, it's really important that we look after our staff properly. We have breakfast every morning. We sit down, we have, whether it's porridge, toast, fruit, coffees, water, you know, that happens every morning without fail. I make donuts on a Friday normally, which is a nice treat. And then in the afternoon, we sit down and we have a family meal. We sit around and eat together. The chef cooks the food, and if they can't cook good staff food, then they shouldn't be chefs. If you can't look after the people who you're working with, then that would be a really sad state of affairs. So we have some pretty good staff food, and it tends to reflect where people come from, which is interesting. So we have different styles of food, you know, depending on who's cooking, and you know, it's interesting. And also part of it is kitchen economy. You know, in every kitchen there is food which we'll say, well, is that the right food that we want to serve the customer? Well, we might have trimmings from meat that we can mince and make into a braise. We might have offcuts that we say, well, maybe we can make a pate with that, or something delicious that the staff will really appreciate. And it can be cooked in a South American style or a European style. But, yeah, it'll be interesting and delicious.
Backtracking a little bit, I wanted to move on to how you access your fish. I love your connections with people out in their day boats.
Well, we have this really sad statistic in the UK that we have 90% or 95% of our fish that we consume is just 5 species. So we're trying to turn against the tide a little bit, and there are some people doing some really good, interesting work trying to encourage more diverse fish consumption. But we've got amazing fishermen who are down on the Helford in Cornwall, and they're very forward-thinking. They want to improve the quality of the fish, so they ice slush at sea. They send it to us overnight. They pay their fishermen properly to look after the fish and to catch it sustainably, so using gill nets or lines, hand lines. So because they're paying the fishermen properly, there's less space for the middleman. So we want to buy direct. That way, everybody gets enough money to make it worthwhile. The fishermen get paid properly. We get good value fish. And because it's such good quality, we can then pass that on to our customers without charging the earth. Again, it just all feels good and comfortable. Now, down in Cornwall, they've got very mixed fishery. So we have lots and lots of different species of fish. We're up to 43 different species of fish now in the last 4.5 months, which is very good. Some of those fish, well, there are issues around fish, and in terms of sustainability, you can be told you should eat this and you shouldn't eat that because it's been red listed or green listed, or everything's got ratings and logos, and it can be confusing. And I think for people who are going in entry level, then a logo can be really good. It gives them a starting point to know where to go. But when you start to understand more and you start to talk to fishermen and you start to understand these guys have been working for generations and generations, they have really, really close link, not waiting for data to arrive to tell them what to do, or out at sea fishing, and they see what we use their knowledge, and we benefit from their knowledge, and we build a relationship to have a better understanding of what we should be eating, and you know, to understand that relationship. And I think when there are fish that sometimes might be higher up on the risk scale, as it were, in terms of sustainability, what we should be looking at more is the method of capture. You know, how are we catching fish? And if your fish is gillnet caught or line caught, then it's much more likely that if fish is caught in that way, then it is sustainably caught. If it's trawled, well, we can't keep trawling all the fish out the sea because it's too aggressive a method. It damages the environment where the fish is living and breeding. And so we need to look at capture method much more. That's my opinion. So by doing that, we're allowed to have access to a much more diverse range of species, and that makes for a much more interesting kitchen. You know, to be able to prepare all these different fish every day just keeps things interesting.
Peter keeps pointing at this menu, because he wants everybody to know what we ate. One of the things that I think we were really excited about, well, there were so many things, but we loved the razor clams. Are they local?
So these are from Dorset, so down in the southwest, and especially at low tides. So everything runs on the lunar cycle, and when there are big movements in the tide, it makes the razor clams more accessible. When the tide's far out, they live right down on the low tide mark, and guys go out and put salt into the holes and pull the razor clams up. They're beautiful though. Really, really succulent, really tender, so sweet. And just a simple herb dressing. I mean, it doesn't need really anything more than that. And I think, again, a bad statistic, most of our shellfish in this country goes over to the continent, so to mainland Europe. People from the UK go on holiday and they say, wow, we had amazing shellfish when we went to France and to Spain. But it's British shellfish, you know, it just gets exported out there. So it's crazy, you know, we should be eating a much wider range of things here at home.
Well, also, of course, we love the Colchester rocks. The raw oysters are just fat. We've had them 3 days in a row. I can't even apologize enough for that. We also had skate wing. Where does that come from?
So when we call it skate wing, so the skate or ray family numbers several species. Skate itself is outlawed, so we're not allowed to land it and use it at all in the UK. So the ray family, this was a blonde ray, and there are about 7 or 8 species that we use, from cuckoo ray, blonde ray, sandy, small-eyed, other various ones. Blonde ray eats really well. It's got good coarse grain, and it's very succulent. Again, from down on the Helford, they catch these mainly around the mouth of the river and in some of the smaller bays just outside the Helford. That would have been caught either by Willie on his boat Foxy Lady or by Chris Bean on Lady Hamilton.
Totally blows me away. Of course, I loved it. And it was on the bone, a cartilage actually, not bone. I love that. I love the black-faced lamb, which is from a local producer. And it was beautiful, served with roasted beetroot, which is... Peter was in love with the oxtail with the green sauce. What else is that green sauce called? It's called Grevesh.
So, for me, green sauce can be salsa verde, sauce vierge. A lot of people do a green sauce chimichurri in South America. It's something that's got a bit of bite to it, a bit of acidity, so either lemon juice or vinegar. It's got lots of fresh herbs and then some oil to smooth things out. In England, we would call that green sauce, and normally there'd be some like really tart apple juice, good fresh herbs, and that would be served with cold meats. And it just works well. It helps to liven the palate and appreciate the more savory flavors of the ox tongue.
Well, I mean, I'm just starting to go through this menu with our listeners, but I mean, I can say what you can count on coming here is, first of all, you're going to be welcomed. It's a warm, welcoming environment. The staff is not just welcoming, they're extraordinarily professional as well. You'll find interesting things on the menu, such as we had gull eggs, which apparently are laid only 2 weeks out of the whole entire year. And we had goat fry, mixed goat fry with innards and whatnot. Spiced cauliflower. We had these asparagus, which is, of course, in style right now. I mean, not in style, in season right now. And what I mean, there are all kinds of other things. The menu is going to change seasonally, obviously, but you probably do it even daily, I would think. And you look for things that are more interesting, right?
So yeah, we print the menu sometimes twice a day. Even then, we may have interesting things which we'll only have a few portions of, so we might have to verbalize. So we try to keep it as fresh as possible. I mean, I'm looking for a paper that we can reprint on that we don't, because obviously printing paper all the time is not the greatest thing environmentally. So we're challenging people to try and find us a type that we can reprint the ink on and then somehow wipe it clean, which it must be possible. There'll be somebody out there who can help us with it. So the Sustainable Restaurant Association, we're working closely with them to fix problems like that. But in terms of the changing menu, that helps people to understand what our style is. If they come in every time and it's the same food, then it would seem slightly disingenuous. We want the food to move on and to progress through the season. So when it's a cold winter's day, you get something that's, you know, really hearty. And when the sun comes out, you get something light and fresh. And the seasons have the right kind of things available at the right times of year. If you're happy to work with farmers who are interested in doing that, and if you're happy to work with fishermen who do the right thing, and it makes it more interesting for everybody involved.
One of the fascinating things you talked to us about was that you had conversations with Alessandro Porcelli about possibility of doing a cook it raw style of thing in London, but certainly it seems like you talked to us about a cooperation between chefs and restaurateurs like yourself, young chefs and restaurateurs across the city, and sounded like that was really fun.
I think when I look at organized events where chefs get together and do things that are high profile, I think back to the times when I've been invited by the fishermen to go down and visit them and go out and go dabbing with them. So we go spearfishing for flounders every Good Friday. For the last 5 years, I've been going and doing that. You know, that's something that real people are already doing, and you know, communities of people do interesting things with food. And I think I would feel very, very strange trying to tell people they need to organise things when actually lots of people do organise things very well for themselves already. And perhaps it's just more my place to try and help make connections and talk about, for example, the dabbing and, you know, doing interesting things rather than trying to pretend that it's me inventing that. You know, I'm not doing anything new. And there are people out there who are amazing producers. I'm very happy to highlight those people who are doing interesting stuff and to collaborate with people who are interested in joining in with seasonal, sustainable, you know, good, clean, fair food. But I'm by no means inventing the principles of it.
Well, Peter, I must say that not only do you cook delicious food, have an interesting menu, and have a very hospitable place here, but you really have a lot of thought behind us about everything you do and a lot of good, fun spirit about it all, too. We really enjoy you. Thanks for joining us as a new friend.
And we'll be back with what some people are calling the hottest table in town right after the break, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next stop was in a very interesting venue.
Shall we say?
Yes, it was certainly interesting.
When we say the restaurant was in Shoreditch Town Hall, you might picture something like a municipal cafeteria, but it turns out that the old Shoreditch Borough Town Hall has been turned over as a reuse for a variety of different things, including a combination bar and restaurant, which everybody's talking about. Right? I mean, yeah, everybody.
The collection of talent. It's on
everybody's tongue.
It's just amazing.
Yep. Remarkable
and
chef.
The number of chefs and that, you know, per the ratio of chefs to diners is incredible.
Was it a lot? I don't know.
Yeah, they were.
The funny part about it is that the one of the owners that we talked to, Johnny Smith, is a failed rock singer, successful restaurateur.
He was a guitarist. No,
well, yeah,
I don't
well,
remember.
Whatever.
He was
a popular musician, and
yes,
that's how he met. One of his partners at the very least. You've got really a remarkable dining adventure, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything's thought through, and I'd say very smart.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the people there were there to be seen.
The digs were a little odd. But
yeah, the people were there to be seen.
Yeah, and the decor is smart and
but they were there to eat and drink, which is, of course, why we were there and why you might want to go there yourself. So here's Johnny Smith talking about the Clove Club.
We're talking to Johnny Smith, which I think sounds like an old blues song, right, Johnny?
Well, Johnny Smith was actually a blues jazz guitarist circa 1950, around then, so you're not wrong.
You know, I made that up in my head. Who knew it was right? But okay, so you were a musician. Explained a little bit the transition you made into being a restaurateur.
I spent my latter teenage years and most of my 20s in bands, playing instruments and then kind of DJing and producing music. Never really earned much money from doing it, which I'm sure a lot of musicians can connect with. So on the side, I used to work in restaurants with Daniel, who is my other business partner in crime. Towards the end of our 20s, we started throwing supper clubs in our flat where we'd get great chefs to come in and cook, and then we'd get DJ friends of ours to come in and create playlists for the night, and they went really well. We started working with a couple of chefs in particular, James Lowe and Isaac McHale, on a regular basis. We did different events in different spaces, and it went very well, and the energy was with restaurants, so now I'm doing that.
Now, Isaac McHale eventually became your chef here at Clover Club, right? And we're not going to actually talk to him, but tell me a little bit about his background. He's been a chef for a long time.
Yeah, he's been a chef since his early 20s. He grew up in Glasgow. I think his first love of cooking was actually when we wanted to make Indian food. He used to get a pakora takeaway, and then ever since then he was transfixed with being able to make it himself. And then he moved to London, worked in a number of places, but spent a good long stint at the Ledbury, which is now number one restaurant in the country.
That is, by the way, our favorite London restaurant. Are we going to have samplings of the Ledbury here?
At the Clove Club. Oh, definitely. You'll have a dash of the Ledbury, but with a bigger slice of the Clove Club.
Okay, we are where? Give me a geographical location of where we are. And while you're at it, we're in an historical building. Could you tell us about that?
So we are in Shoreditch, which is in the heart of East London, just 10 minutes away from upstairs at the Ten Bells, our other restaurant. And we are in Shoreditch Town Hall, which is a Grade 2 listed building, a fantastic building, which you can only kind of believe when you see it.
Now, I have menus here. You have two parts to this particular operation, one being the restaurant and the other one being the bar, as I understand it. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. When we first came to the site, and if any of the listeners out there, if they ever come to the Clove Club, you first walk into a bar area, and then the other side of the building is the restaurant. So it's naturally divided into two spaces, which kind of gave birth to the concept of how we wanted to do the food. Isaac's a very ambitious chef, and he wanted to do a set menu. So in the dining room, we serve his five-course set menu, and in the bar area, we serve a sharing plate a la carte menu.
Wow. Now, how does one get in? I have this feeling coming here that it's almost like a private club. Is that just a carryover from the supper club days?
Well, the name, yeah, would suggest it's a club, but in fact it's not. And it's not exclusive at all. You know, we want everyone to come. But we are getting busy now. It's the hottest ticket in town, apparently.
Yeah, we've got a great deal of press. What's the general philosophy of the food here? I mean, what do people expect to eat when they come here? What kind of food?
What do they expect to eat? I think some people expect to be taken to the moon and back after all the press we've had. And, yeah, people's expectations are very high, but the food is amazing. Isaac has a love of all things, but he vegetables. And, you know, he wants to bring British vegetables and vegetables from around the world to the fore a little bit, whatever it is, whether it's kohlrabi or beautiful new seasons asparagus, just some things that maybe not everyone is used to ordering or eating in a restaurant. And with the set menu, it's a great opportunity for people to try things they wouldn't usually order from an a la carte menu.
Okay, so I'm looking here at two different menus. One's the bar menu, and then the other one is the restaurant menu. Bar menu, describe briefly what's on that.
So a variety of hot and cold dishes. To start with, we've got our own salumi, which we're now selling. So Isaac's been curing legs of lamb. He's been making his homemade mortadella, black pudding, and some pancetta crudo. So that's a really nice way to start. And then some fun things to share. And when I say fun, they're quite visually striking and fun. So his signature buttermilk chicken. So it's chicken, which is coated in tapioca starch and deep fried, and then seasoned with ground pine needles and salt. And then he serves it in a big bowl of pine. So it comes to the table and it just looks amazing. And of course, fried chicken, it does taste amazing as well. Radishes. So beautiful breakfast radishes with a gochujang mayonnaise, which is like a bright orange, and then black sesame over the top, which looks like soil. Looks like the radishes have been pulled straight out of the ground. And then a couple of other hot dishes. Tonight we've got some roast Yorkshire lamb from our friend George in Swaledale, who drives down once a week with amazing lamb. Serving it with anchovy emulsion, some very quickly wilted spinach leaves, and crisp potato. So deliciousness, lots of deliciousness.
I had no idea. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think we get the general idea. Now, this place is really serious about
home-baked bread,
right.
Yeah, so we knew we wanted to bake our own bread. When we opened, we'd never baked any. But our friend Jack Beer, who works here now, he's the head baker. He bakes a delicious organic stone ground.
I need to ask this question. Who actually comes here? Of course, we're early, so I can't see who comes here. So tell me who actually comes here.
What people? Who are the people? It's a total mix of everyone. And obviously, lots of friends of ours come to the restaurant, so there's musicians and people in art, but some, you know, you get business city boys come in, or you get folks from outside of town who've read something in the newspaper. It's a total mix. It's a very eclectic mix.
Well, I mean, I think this is really very exciting because, I mean, it was below my radar, and now it's riding real high on that radar. And yeah, it sure is.
Let's pick up a couple more of these guys from the menu. I notice you have gull eggs, yes, yeah, which we had just a couple of days ago, and apparently the season's only going to last about another 10 days.
So, black-headed gull eggs from the marshes of Loch Ness in Ireland, served with celery salt and buckwheat, and then a delicious lovage dip.
For sausage freaks like me, wood pigeon sausages and 10 bells ketchup. Now, that's your other restaurant, but what makes it better than Heinz?
Heinz couldn't make it this good. So, not many people have eaten a pigeon, let alone wood pigeon sausages. And lots of Vietnamese restaurants around this local area that serve the famous sriracha sauce, which we love. So this is Isaac's homemade version of sriracha.
You have a full bar here. That's a different crowd separate from the restaurant.
A different crowd? No, I'd say it's the same crowd. We get people who come and eat in the restaurant, and then the next time they want to come and eat in the bar because the two experiences are slightly different. In the bar, we play music. It's a little bit more lively, you know. In the restaurant, it's a bit more focused on the food.
Who are your icons in contemporary music?
Icons in contemporary music. James Blake's up there. He's a pretty good chap. I say, if I'm speaking for everyone, J.D. Twitch and the Optimo Boys, and of course Sam Willis of Walls.
How about older stuff? What?
Oh, Johnny Cash, Crosby, Stills and Nash, David Bowie, you name it. There's too many of them.
How about, now you may not have icons and mentors. We already know about your chef Isaac liking the Leadberry. Did you and your other partners ever have an ideal for the kind of food you wanted in your restaurant?
Like I said, when Daniel and I, we used to work at a pizza restaurant in Manchester, which was a great pizza restaurant. But when we moved to London, I started working at Great Queen Street's restaurant and he at St. John. Kind of both there, quite iconic in the London food scene. And I suppose they influenced our ideals of what we wanted to do in food. Well, especially to kind of to do with the service. And then Isaac was a huge, you know, Isaac and James of the Young Turks, they were really big influences on us. Just watching them work with the menus every day and work with the produce and come up with the dishes. That was very inspirational.
Were you still in Manchester when Juniper was going?
Juniper restaurant, yes. In Wilmslow Juniper?
Altrincham,
one of them. Yeah, I remember Juniper, but I've never been. Now they've got the French, which is Simon Rogan's new restaurant in the Midland, which apparently is one to watch.
Oh, he's incredible. We've eaten at his place. Yeah. What's the chef from?
Paul Kitching, the chef at Juniper, was a little crazy. Was it Tom? No, it was Paul Kitching. There's another kitchen called Tom. Who's in Glasgow? I think he's in Edinburgh, and we heard that Paul Kitchen's also in Edinburgh, but we're not sure. Yeah, well, we went to the one in Manchester called Juniper, and it was one of our more interesting and one of our least favorite dining experiences. If it's possible for both of those things to exist, I'm sure that's not what's going to happen to us tonight. But do you have a final thought for On the Menu listeners around the world?
I think anybody who comes to London should come to the Clover Club because you'll have an amazing time. And I mean that.
I think you do, and I'm looking forward.
So there you have it. Some great new places to go, some great new dining adventures, some interesting parts of London that perhaps you wouldn't ordinarily go to. You, of course, hear it all first here at On the Menu, and we will be back same time, same place next week. We hope you'll join us then. And in
bye
the meantime,
bye.
Oops. And in the meantime,
I said that already.
We'll do it again.
Bye bye.